I stretch the remit a little, and the animals in the films I want to talk about aren't always necessarily small. It was the size of the roles that they play within the films that I was thinking about. They have small, minor supporting roles. I hope you might allow me that. Now, what I want to talk about today is contextualized by the existence of what I see, anyway, as a current wave, though perhaps not something one would want to call a movement, a third such major wave after that of the 1950s and again of the 1980s, of British cinema which draws upon and does a range of interesting things with conventions of realism. The success of contemporary directors such as Andrew Arnold, Cleo Barnard, Joanna Hogg, Shane Meadows and others, some of whom I'll look at, speaks to this. And one way that I want to test or explore the imaginative force of the films of this current wave is against a multifaceted and interdisciplinary contemporary critical paradigm, that of animal studies. So my questions, I suppose, initially are broad ones. Can animal studies provide useful ways into these films? And perhaps more ambitiously, or I'm potentially here to be told naively, might these films even have things in turn to offer the academic discourses that make up animal studies? Do these films, which undoubtedly are centrally concerned with human social as well as domestic private arrangements, do they give the animals they present much room for themselves, so to speak? As in, are we always talking about the humans when we're talking about these animals? Am I likely only to be talking about the animals in these films as cliched, straightforward metaphors? Or, I hope, might the animals in these films provide one of the ways in which we might locate more complex and shifting meaning systems in the films, in contrast to that broad reputation social realist cinema has for being cliched, straightforward, self-righteous, dull genre work? So, like I said, the animals that I want to look at have minor supporting roles in the narratives of these films. However, as well as looking at how these supporting roles form part of the film's internally generated meaning systems, that is, how a particular animal might be looked at by a character as well as by an audience, I want to place such interpretations within a broader context. So this is because it seems to me that such meanings also operate in part according to intriguing parallels, which I didn't really expect to be there when I started out thinking about animals in these films, but rewatching all the films in succession has led me to believe this. That the meanings that the animals are involved within the films operate in part according to parallels between the film's overarching narratives and mainstream Hollywood-based films that indeed do focus on animals that have more central roles in the films. So, writing in his 2002 book, Animals in Films, Jonathan Burt noted of The Horse Whisperer that, quote, the film has a number of plot motifs familiar to many animal films, such as overcoming loss, family difficulties, and a reintegration of identity. Then going even further into mainstream cinema, Burt pointed out that, quote, in many family films featuring animals, for example, one of the most common motifs concerns the missing or dead parent, and the manner in which animals come to heal or in some ways compensate for that absence. Such narrative motifs, as Burt calls them, pertaining to repercussions of and coming to terms with local scale emotional and psychological trauma, also structure a number of recent and contemporary social realist films, where the figure of the child or young adult and their coming of age drama is often so central. And strikingly, the animals of such contemporary films play roles that are, while nevertheless subtle and variable, comparable, I think, with those in mainstream animal films that Burt points to. So, to some of the films, one might think, for example, of Lynn Ramsey's 1999 Ratcatcher, a film that brings together extremes of documentary-style realism with poetic flights of imagination, symbolism and surrealism, in the story of what happens to the young boy James and his fractured family after James witnesses a friend drowning in the canal. Now, the creatures of this film are rats and mice. The former is vermin, which proliferate during Glasgow's dustman strike of 1974, and which are therefore hunted, while mice and gerbils are kept as pets, though they are rarely treated much better. There's one particular striking scene that I want to highlight, in which a mouse becomes literally otherworldly as it flies to the moon. Now, the mouse, this is the mouse in the cage there, Snowball, is tied to that red balloon, you can see, by his owner Kenny, who yields to the envious pressure of his peers, and the mouse and balloon fly off into the sky. We then see Snowball flying to the moon, where he lands, and we discover that the moon is populated by other mice. The camera then pulls back from this black and white shot of the populated moon to ease us gently back into the real as the moon fades to become analog television noise, or snow as it's also called, like the mouse. And we see James, the film's protagonist, asleep on the sofa, presumably dreaming the scene that we've just witnessed. Now James will go on to tell Kenny that Snowball will have died as a result of the prank of tying him to the balloon. So James is aware that there is a real death involved in the game. But I think that this mouse's imagined safe landing also cushions James's response to death more broadly, that is, to the death of his friend in the canal. So he imagines a safe landing. Snowball's otherworldly route of escape foreshadows a later scene in which James also escapes to an alien landscape of a suburban housing development to which families he hopes his are being relocated. Through the window of one of these not yet finished houses, James discovers a still untouched semi-pastoral idyll, a version, I think, of Snowball's moon. It's an unreal window framed somewhat like a cinema screen, but a live screen through which James can escape, and like Snowball, he can find a measure of peace in the newness of the alien landscape. In a sense then, Snowball's story is also James's story, with their imaginary endings both also shown up to be fictions, in that events in the real world will kill James just as they did Snowball. I suppose I should also apologise for giving away some of the endings of these films. But the films are worth seeing despite that. And minor animal roles that appear as comforts to and share certain circumstances with the lead role of a child suffering traumas also occur in Samantha Morton's semi-autobiographical The Unloved from 2009. This is the film about Morton's own childhood in the care system in Nottingham, and it's a film which has been receiving some renewed attention recently after Morton went public in September 2014 about her own abuse in care following the revelations about Rotherham. And Morton's semi-avatar in the film is Lucy, who, after witnessing a scene of sexual abuse in her care home, gets dressed and wanders the nighttime streets of Nottingham. Morton has Lucy wearily looking at a spider web, perhaps at its connotations of entrapment as well as its order, its systematised neatness in contrast to Lucy's own messy lack of clear information. And during her walk, Lucy explores Nottingham's historical church cemetery. Can you see that? I've brightened it a little bit compared to how it is in the original film. Hopefully you can see that's going on there. Where in a section dedicated to the graves of children, she discovers and sits with a deer. Now, while on the one hand this scene might be read as simple childish wish fulfilment, you know, a kind of Bambi fantasy to substitute Lucy's missing mother or violent father in the mould, perhaps, that Bert has in mind when he wrote about film animals substituting missing parents. But I think that there's perhaps also something occurring on screen here that involves sound and hearing, and that's not so much Morton straightforwardly co-opting the quality of a deer's hearing as a metaphor for Lucy's attentiveness, but that in being present with Lucy for this brief period acknowledges in an oblique way the unavoidable impact of witnessing, coming as it does after the scene of Lucy witnessing sexual abuse. A more substantial role, though still a supporting one and also one that involves escape and witnessing in a coming-of-age drama, is that of the horse in Cleo Barnard's The Selfish Giant from 2013. The film's central character, Arbor, who's here on the left, suffers from a hyperactivity disorder, and with his friend Swifty on the right there, steals and sells copper wiring along with legally found scrap metal. The two boys are paid for the metals by a middle-aged man who owns the horse he loans to the boys for work and which he also uses for harness racing. Now, it transpires that Swifty has some kind of communicative ability with this horse, and he's entrusted with it to race. Thus, the horse, and indeed other horses, become a site of conflict between the two boys, with Arbor envious of the rewards his friend's ability accrues. So a fracturing point in their relationship comes when Arbor proposes to test whether a loose electricity wire is live with a young foal. It's something to which Swifty forcefully objects, and he forces his friend down on the ground and says, "How would you like it?" That foal is later found dead, electrocuted by the wire, though we don't suspect Arbor of having anything to do with it. really what's happening, I think, is that similar to how Snowball foreshadowed James's imaginary escape and real death in Ratcatcher, these scenes in The Selfish Giant presage Swifty's own death by electrocution when he and Arbor try to remove underground high voltage wiring. Now, after that death, Arbor struggles to cope. It's a death, of course, for which he's partly responsible, and he refuses to come out from under his bed until his friend's mother visits as a sign of forgiveness, a mark perhaps of that reintegration Bert spoke of in mainstream animal films. The final scene of the film finds Arbor gently cleaning and caring for the horse. It's the first time he's done anything but frighten it. And so I think his coming of age has been bound up with his treatment of others, both animal and human. And this shot of the horse seemingly meeting the camera's gaze, I think, for a brief moment, is the film's final image. Another British realist film from 2013, is For Those in Peril, directed by Paul Wright. And again, this tells a story of a traumatised youth. And also, like The Selfish Giant, the family at the centre of the film is missing a father. Though here, the familiar loss is more immediately of a brother. And it's this loss which creates a space into which some of the animals are brought. Wright's atmospheric film makes much of its remote, weather-lashed location, which is a remote Scottish village, to tell the story of Aaron, the only survivor of a fishing boat disaster which drowned his idolised older brother along with five other young men. Now, the creatures of this film become increasingly strange and are often present as spectral, ghost-like figures, while a human-animal boundary also starts to blur throughout the film. Setting all this up, and it's hard to talk about these, how things are kind of set up without showing you whole sequences of films. I'm talking about the first 15 minutes of a film, and obviously there isn't time to show you the first 15 minutes of a film. But what I think sets up this strangeness in that first 15 minutes of the film is the fact that the only dialogue that takes place in the presence of dead or dying creatures. So in the first instance, Aaron's mother talks to a colleague as she's cutting the industrialised fish. And secondly, a group of local boys ask Aaron about the fishing accident while they're all chasing and killing a rabbit. And when the third instance of dialogue around that 15-minute mark comes, with Aaron being questioned by a psychiatrist, that contiguity of dialogue with death mediated by creatures has been firmly established. And this contiguity coalesces around a children's story that Aaron's mother tells him. And it's the clip of that children's story that I'm going to try and play. It's about 2 minutes, I think.
One day, the devil in the ocean cursed the town. It took all the fish and all the little children into its big, dirty belly. And everyone was scared and everyone was sad. And they knew that only if the devil was caught would things go back to the way they were before.
But then what happened?
One little boy who'd lost everyone he really loved went out to the water to find a monster. He went so far under the water that he turned into a fish. And he swam all day and all night looking for his family. And one day, after searching the ocean so long he was ready to give up, he saw the big monster sleeping at the bottom of the ocean. And he swam right into its mouth and up into its big belly. And in there, he found all the fish, all the little children, everyone he'd ever loved.
And everything was okay again.
He set them all free. The devil was gone forever. The curse left the town. Nobody got scared anymore. Nobody got sad or ill. And all the little boys and girls would live forever. Everything went back to the way it was.
Now, it might seem that we could be relatively confident that we're dealing with metaphor, with the story clearly a straightforward, if prescient, rendering of Aaron's plight. With his turning into a fish and the salvation found in the monster's belly, perhaps also his own return to an embryonic state, re-entering the safety of his mother's womb. Aaron has internalised this story that is itself about internalisation. And yet that straightforwardness is pushed to an extreme by Aaron when he cuts what he thinks of as gills into his neck before he dives underwater, as in the story, but to what we imagine, of course, must be his death. We then see that classic panic scene of the mother rushing through the town to the beach, and we expect, of course, that she'll find her dead son. But what she, along with us and the rest of the village, finds is, in fact, the real physical monster of that story. And this twist whereby the imaginary animal is made fleshly and real has, I think, entirely subverted our expectations of realism, both psychological and aesthetic. Our final contemporary director that I want to look at, whose films operate via a range of realist conventions, is Andrea Arnold. Arnold's early short film from 2001, which is called Dog, centres on the young Leah, whose boyfriend kicks to death a harmless dog. Leah runs home, only to find a mother waiting to beat her for stealing, and Leah's mode of defence is to take on the now dead dog's bark, in an early instance of the ways in which Arnold seeks to blur boundaries between the animal and human. I'm going to briefly play this clip, and hopefully it's not loads louder. Be prepared for it to be really loud. I think she actually looked genuinely perturbed there, like she wasn't quite expecting that. A human and animal also merge somewhat. I hesitate to say the humans become animal via Deleuze and Guattari's mutual deterritorialization. In Arnold's third and Oscar-winning short, Wasp, from 2003. Now, Arnold tends to derive her scripts from a single and striking initial image, and with her early shorts, these are also images upon which sympathies for the characters turn. Here we have what I assume was the original imaginary image of this film, of a wasp entering the mouth of a child, left with its older sisters outside a pub, while their mother, Zoe, meets an old boyfriend. And it's tempting to read this wasp as not only an alien other, I think, but also as a creature which brings together the various status of the different characters at the end of summer, who are hungry for food, the children who are left outside the pub, looking for partnership, Zoe, or alone, like the child can seem, or a combination of these. But it's really Arnold's 2009 Fish Tank that I think arguably provides her most intriguing screen creatures. Along with lead character Mia, at various points as a dragonfly, a horse, a hamster, a dog, and inevitably perhaps a fish, which all take on minor roles in the film. And all are in various ways housed, trained, domesticated according to their context. But I want to look just briefly at one of these, which is that horse. Now, Fish Tank is yet another coming-of-age film with an absent father, though in this case it's really two absent fathers. And for the 15-year-old Mia, coming to the age of 16 becomes synchronous with a kind of inevitable death. Having had a brief affair with her mother's then-boyfriend, Mia discovers he's married with a family, another family that is, living in what they call the new estate, a middle-class life of apparent stability, in contrast to Mia's own sense of fractured loneliness in the council block, whose rooms and windows give a kind of sense to the film's title. Now Mia wonders, this is towards the end of the film, she wonders what has happened to a horse she'd tried to set free early in the film, only to be told it had gotten sick and been shot. The horse's owner tells Mia, quote, she was 16, it was her time, unquote. It was then the horse's time, just as it is Mia's, as she also reaches 16. Now with this horse and the other film animals that I'm looking at, it's difficult coming onto impossible, like I was saying, to really convey any sort of sense of their affect, of their emotional impact, when taking them out of the context of the experience of the film as a whole. You know, it doesn't really suffice just to summarise a scene, but that's what I'm having to do. It's partly the fact that Mia has nowhere else to turn after her disillusion that makes her search for the now dead horse a poignant mirror of Mia's own life, highlighting as it does the contrast between the talkative ways in which she's been misled and what John Gray called the silence of animals that illustrates her lack of solace. However, what we might be able to say clearly and without relying on the context of the whole film about Fishtank's horse as well as about other animals are pointed to is that they are perhaps examples of what Randy Malmud called in 2012 acculturated animals. That's creatures whose life is wholly determined by and therefore subservient to human culture, its meanings, its desires, its powers. Writing about Judith Butler's Frames of War as a way of seeing the distortion and power dynamics at work in framing an animal, such as via a cinematic screen, Malmud writes that, quote, human representations of animals in visual culture are inherently biased and self-serving. However, I would argue that in focusing primarily on films which make animals the very centre of the films, as the majority of those who have written on animal studies and film have done, as far as I can tell, but with good understandable good reason, what happens is that original creative problematizations of framed animal-human relationships might be missed. Now, while I've argued that there are narrative crossovers between mainstream Hollywood films and those of independent British realist drama, that in itself, I think, is an intriguing aspect of these contemporary films, and it's also, of course, not the whole story of the animals in those films. Malmud writes that, quote, we look at acculturated animals as we look at cars and nudes and houses, inflected by the drives of acquisition, consumption, power, control. And while I certainly see the horse of Fishtank, for example, as inflected by such drives, that's precisely the point, and I'm made to see the horse, as well as Mia, as inflected by such dynamics. I do not look at either as I might, let's say, at an advert of a car. Indeed, the way I, as a viewer, look at Mia in Fishtank is precisely one of the film's major concerns. It's a concern carefully navigated, for example, in a scene where Mia sings and dances for her mother's boyfriend just before the two have sex. That's Mia and the boyfriend. While Arnold's camera, Arnold's camera is itself a protective force around Mia. It stays very close to her and refuses until very late to pull back and watch her entire body dance as the boyfriend is doing, obviously. So it refuses to crudely, blatantly sexualize her. The films that Malmud argues provide positive representations of animals, Disney family films such as Ratatouille, I think leave little room for independent cinematic innovation within different genre traditions. So I suppose what I want to say is that I hope to have shown a little of how the animals of these few contemporary dramas can help us to read the films more thoroughly, while at the same time how doing so requires an attention to the animals themselves not accounted for in an argument wholly hostile to framed, acculturated animals. The renowned Australian film critic Barbara Creed wrote in 2009 that, quote, the story of the screen animal, its past and future, is only just being told. So I hope that the interrelated worlds of animals, children and their fractured families and communities in contemporary British realist cinema can play some part in telling that story. Thank you.
Thank you very much, David. Pity about the absence of spoiler alerts.
But, yeah.